But first I'd like to conjure up a distant, spooky howl while the moon is high, and some mysterious splashing sound from the beach. They're not quite waves, are they? And so we'll begin with Australian writer Margot Lanigan, author of both short stories and novels and a vastly entertaining blog. I spoke to Lanigan back in April last year about her novel Sea Hearts. Since we spoke, it's been published in the USA under the title The Brides of Roll Rock Island. I like our title, to be honest, but it is indeed the story of women drawn up from the sea. And the story centres around the woman who can do that summoning, Miscela Prout, with her magical connection with seals. Let's start then with Margot Lanigan giving a taste of this world.
I had left my coat up at Holman's. Mam took hers down from the peg, put it on, but did not button it. She picked up the tied skin and the patch skin she had made for me, and I put my hands on the latch and doorknob. We looked at each other, my dad's absence thunderous around us. So as not to hear it, I lifted the latch and pulled open the door. We went out, the two of us, into the night, and I closed the house behind us. She took my hand as we started walking, and hers was cold and tight. I thought she smiled down on me out of the stars, but the light was not good, and her hair shadowed her face. She might just as easily have been wincing. Down slippy-slap we went, the wind skirling and twiddling around us, caught in the narrow ways. Every now and again a strong breath from the sea would push at our faces, green and alive and massive. When that happened, Mam would almost run a few steps, as if being summoned more sharply. The water was rucked up and difficult-looking between the moles. I thought I saw seal heads out there, two or three, but when I looked again, I could not find them. I thought then that seals were strewn along the stony beach, all shades of them, but no. Those were clothes, coats and dresses, trousers and jackets. Oh, it was as frightening as if there had been bodies there, of all the boys and Mams I knew. Mam squeezed my hand. "Let's go along," she said. "I don't want to leave from here. I want wilder sea." "Wilder than that?" I stumbled after her, eyeing the crisscrossing foam between the moles. I hoped this was a dream. Certainly I had never felt such terror except in dreams. Mam was entirely sure of herself, though. If I stayed right with her, perhaps I would catch some of her confidence. I waded down the sand dune at the end of the harbour front and ran out after her across the sand of the northern beach. The wind blew strongly, with no more buildings in its way. The water shouldered up and smashed itself on the sand before us. "Let us run home," I wished I could say, "and all go on as before." But clothes were scattered about here, too, half in and half out of the shallows, and lengths of twine from Grinny and Batten's bundles. So many Mams and boys had already gone. And Mam knelt before me, humming, unbuttoning my shirt, and her face in the moonlight was clear, a light as the moon it was, and I was at first too cheered by her happiness to voice my doubts, and then I was too shocked by the sea wind and the floating spume on my naked skin. Last of all, she took off my boots and trousers. I steadied myself with my hands on her shoulders, steadied myself against the thought that she would not have shoulders much longer. We would neither of us have shoulders or hands. Now I was clothed only in the night cold and my terror of the water, shivering and goose-fleshed top to toe. "Step in," she said, and then I was preoccupied, wasn't I, with fitting myself into the sheepskin suit with its scratchy seaweed seams, trying to keep my balance with my feet thrust into the narrow tail of the thing. She checked that my toes and then my fingers were pushed fully into the suit's tied sleeve ends. She pulled the ragged hood mask down over my face and set to fixing it at the neck. It was as if she stitched my mouth shut and my chin to my chest. She had never been so brisk and firm about her sewing before. I stood there with my neck pulled into an ache behind. Through the eye holes I watched her as well as I could, so as not to look at the waves, so as not to think too clearly about what we were doing. She flung down her dress among the others, took off her underthings and held them up and with a joyful laugh let the wind snatch them out of her hand. And then she was just flesh and fur and flying hair, unworried by the cold, uncluttered by the trappings of land clothing. She pulled the knot of the coat bundle undone in a single joyful movement. The skin fell open on the stones and with a shriek to myself I jumped back from it, so lively did it settle and so blackly shine there, fattening and smoothing out as I watched. I gasped inside my dry leather mask and my flattened hair crawled with sweat and fear. She lunged at me and kissed the mask of me and shouted something, perhaps in seal language, for I could not hear sense in it. Then she lifted the swelling coat high and it sank upon and encompassed her, clung on close, clung to its own edges around her. Clap and clop and zlip it went and snick until she was disappeared within, and then she fell from standing, foot fins together, straight into the wavelets, where she was now seal, and she flung herself down towards the deeper water.
That terrible longing and the transformation with the taking on and off of those coats, I mean, it's such a powerful part of the story, but transformation is something that comes up in a lot of genre fiction, vampires, werewolves. But with the Selkies, you've taken us into at both sides of the story. So can you tell us what you're drawing on there?
I think probably I know a lot of legends in their very sort of skeletal form. And what I really want to do is be so absorbed in those stories that I know what the actual thing... I think the Selkie stories in their traditional forms are very, very sparely told. There's hardly any detail about the actual change that goes on. And that, to me, is the most fascinating part of the story. So I think telling that in as much detail as possible is the thing that fascinates me most about those stories. Just the physical sensations of what it means to turn from one creature into another with one... With a different kind of a body and with a different kind of a mind. And, you know, the seal mind is not exactly an accessible kind of a mind for me, but to imagine where the transformation would take you in your mind as the physical changes were happening in your body.
Well, and of course it is hugely imaginative and magical, and yet as I was reading it, it felt like historical fiction. It felt familiar and British, and as if it might have been set in some gloomy island somewhere in the late, maybe 19th century. So how specifically were you drawing a place? Was it a completely imagined island for you, or was it the Orkney Islands or somewhere off Britain or somewhere off Iceland? Where are we?
We're definitely off Scotland rather than off England or off Iceland. That was just where I got that sort of fingernail holds for the details that I needed to make it seem linked enough to this world. I didn't want it to actually be able to be sheeted home to a particular place, so I didn't want it to be, you know, all written in dialect, but I wanted the sort of suggestion of dialect there and the suggestion of country accents in it. But I used the Orkneys and the Hebrides, the Outer Hebrides, for the details like the kale broth and the kind of rural life, the kind of architecture. Although I actually gave them a lot fancier homes than they would have had in the outer Scottish islands. You know, they actually didn't have to share their rooms with their cows, which I found out later they did.
Yeah. Is this book in conversation with other books or other writers who also play with those stories? Or did you just, as you say, go from those bare-bone, Selkie stories and just leap off from there?
Yeah, I'd say it's pure self-indulgence, really. No, I didn't see myself as playing with other people's interpretations, particularly a seed that had been planted in me by the old tales, and that was finding its way out of me in a particular way.
Would it be fair to describe this book as a story of longing?
Oh, absolutely. More than longing. Painful yearning, Kate. Absolute horrendous longing. The worst longing you can experience.
That. But who's longing? Tell us more about that.
Everybody's longing. Everybody gets to long. Everybody gets to yearn and be in pain in this story. The Selkies come out of the water and are trapped there. So they are always in a position of longing for their previous life. And then traditionally they find their way back into the sea. And then there's this two-part longing between the Selkies who now that they have a history, like all expatriates, now that they have a history in this other country, do long for that one as well from the sea. And in some of the stories, they do come back and spend some time, you know, on Midsummer Eve, they'll come and dance by on the strand with their earthly families. But there's also the men who are left behind who are are consumed by this horrible longing. Very few stories actually deal with the longing of the children, and I wanted them to be all knotted up in this and suffering too.
They are suffering.
They probably have the worst of it because those boys, and it is only boy children in this story, can also witness the suffering of their parents as well as longing for that golden time when they were together, knowing that that golden time was based on terrible things that their fathers ought not to have done. And they know that they can never claim that time back in the future. They will never...
And there's a certain not entirely spelt out longing for girl children as well.
There is that, yeah. And those girl children, they do happen, but they have to be returned to the sea because being girl children, they are closer to their seal parent than to their earthly parent, so they can't actually survive on land in my version of this tale. So, yes, they get sent back to the sea for their bringing up and the mothers never see them again.
And another type of longing, the desire that's spelt out in this from the men, they don't entirely come off well in it, do they?
They look very bad.
What are they longing for? I mean, what do they want?
Well, they're longing for what you only really get a glimpse of the women who really do belong on this island, the red wives who all leave as soon as the men start getting seal wives. And those red wives are very feisty and strong. They have opinions. They have wills, you know, and they are active and they do stuff and they influence things and they demand things. And every now and again in the history of this island, the men just get a bit jack of that. And when they realise that there's this other species of woman, almost literally another species of woman, who will basically just sit and take what they dish out and never really demand anything of them except, I wouldn't mind getting my coat back if you would mind, you know, at some stage, and which they never do.
And they're very sensual and they're into sex.
They're dead sexy, yeah, and they're beautiful women. And actually, I never imagined that the red wives weren't into sex, but I think that possibly, you know, occasionally they like to get on top, and maybe the men weren't all that comfortable about that, whereas I think the Selkie, this will just do it the way you say every time.
Yeah. So a feminist fable?
Sort of, yeah.
Because there's a sort of domestic violence undertone as well in the taking and keeping of the coats, the taking off of other identities.
Yeah. And this originated as a novel. The first version of this was a novel. As a novella. And in that novella there was an explicit translation of that into domestic violence. But I took that out for this. I thought that probably the greatest cruelty was the keeping of them out of the sea. And I thought that was probably sufficient.
But we do have at least one other stroppy female character mm-hmm. who has a huge presence in the book, and that's Miscela. And I've heard some other discussions that people have had with you who seem to be constructing her as an always unsympathetic character. Mm-hmm. I was terribly sympathetic to mm-hmm. her, particularly as a young girl who was bullied and who was trying to make sense of her power and her interaction with the natural world. So tell us about Miscela, the witch. Would you call her a witch?
She's a witch. She's definitely a witch. And she's a witch who doesn't have any real role models. In a couple of earlier versions of the novel, she did have role models, but I took them all away from her and made her struggle along on her own. So as you can see, my modus operandi is just basically make people suffer as much as possible. She is born late in the family, so she's she's not the last child, but she's pretty late in the game. And she's not very attractive. She always thinks of herself as being born after the looks in that family ran out. And the looks are pretty much the only thing that differentiates. You know, everybody's lives are pretty much the same on this island. So the things that differentiate the haves and the have-nots are subtleties in physical attractiveness or you know, slightly more wealth than the person down the road. So she's at a disadvantage and she's a bit of a scapegoat for anything that goes wrong in the family. And she develops, as you would, a healthy resentment of everybody who puts her down. She doesn't know about her powers until they really land on her at about the age of 9. And at that point, quite a lot of the very, very old people in the village realise what she is, and they make all these gestures to kind of appease her and prevent her from doing what witches traditionally do on the island of Roll Rock, which is to make seal women come to the island and steal all the men. So I always imagine this is something that a horrible cycle that happened to this Island over and over again.
But as the book goes on, we see this character, Miscaella, through other people's eyes. Yes. So she becomes less sympathetic and more a creature to be feared.
Yes.
And I'm interested in what that means for you as a writer. Do you keep your sympathy for these difficult characters? How do you feel about her as you're writing her and as you're making her more fearful or fearsome?
I always really liked her. I mean, I do have a soft spot for very cranky postmenopausal characters at the moment. I can't think why. But the very first scene that I ever wrote in the novella that was the precursor to this novel was the scene that is right at the beginning now, where she's on the beach snarling at the children and being the frightening character. So I always knew that she had that aspect to her. And when I came to writing the novel, I wanted to find out what had made her into this creature, and I wanted to get behind her reasons for...
And
for
bullying seems to be
bullying
at least part of it.
Bullying and rejection of various kinds, yes. And never being particularly given the equipment to deal with that or to counter that in any way. So the only ammunition she gets is when her magical powers arrive and she realises, oh, this is the thing with which I can get back at all these people who have been hurting me all these years.
And... they're seal brides or they're sea brides. So what does the sea mean to you? Because you seem to be evoking its power.
What does the sea mean? Well, I think just the vastness and the mystery, the strength of the power of the sea are the things that constitute its allure. You know, you only have to walk along a beach on a stormy day or see one little film clip of the wave coming up on the promenade for a change and to know how dangerous it is. So the danger, but also the beauty of it as well. You
well, because it's a sexy, sensual place in the book as well as a place to be scared of.
Mm.
And I was very happy to see that Miscaella got some pleasure in her life as well.
She did, yes.
And she got it from the sea, shall we say. I'd like to go back to the question of whether you see yourself as a feminist writer or a women's writer, I guess. And there's a line in one of your very recent blog posts where you're talking about writing and you say, how do I draw this goddess or make her presence felt? And I thought, well, what an intriguing question.
It is. It's one that's very much on my mind. That's for my next novel, which is a historical novel about a convict who comes out from Ireland and brings a goddess with him. So
I wasn't sure whether it was a literal question or whether you were conjuring up a muse or your own goddess.
No, it was definitely this goddess in the story, and I'm still she's very soft clay at the moment. I don't know how she's going to turn out. I don't know how I'm going to make her live on the page. She keeps, you know, disappearing and becoming transparent and evanescent, and I want her to be much more concrete than she is.
How concrete do they remain, these characters of yours? Because one of the things that's come up a couple of times in the discussions here is the different approaches that writers have to the longevity of their characters.
Hmm.
What do your characters do? Do they stay in the books or do they... trapes out.
Some of them leak over from story to story. A character like Miscaella has actually, she's about the fourth incarnation of this cranky witch character. A character who is more about moving this particular story along. Like the two Mallet boys, Dominic and Daniel Mallet, I sort of see their stories as pretty much having been done, although the Daniel Mallet character has something of the sensitive boy coming across the heap of corpses in his makeup, which will also leak into another story, I'm sure.
Well, you've partly already answered my next question by referring to the convicts in your next project, because I guess I was wondering how much mythical creatures like sea brides or even seaside witches like Miscaella might swim up in the Pacific in slightly warmer waters. Can they be specifically here?
They can be, yes. I haven't explored that yet. What I'm enjoying with the stories that I've done is the feeling of going to old tales, and those old tales are situated over in Eastern Europe or in the UK, and finding stories that have weathered an awful lot of history already, and they have been told and told until they've been pared back to the bare bones. And I just like the way that those bones, those already existent bones, still carry the power of these stories. Yes, you could have an Australian silky story. I think it would be a very different thing. I'd be willing to give it a go. But it would be quite a different thing, and I wouldn't be able to tell you here and now tonight how it would work. And the society around the people who were affected by the silky visitations would be quite different, so the issues would be slightly different.
And another thing that we've been discussing here in the salons is people's method of writing. Mm-hmm. And you are a very active blogger. And does that help the discipline of your writing, or is that something that's separate
to it? Oh, that's a wonderful form of fruitful procrastination. Being online is kind of the sane-making water cooler conversation that writers haven't been able to get in the past, and it's a wonderful thing to just dip into and dip out of. It's a terrible trap as well that does, you know, lend itself to making you procrastinate further and put off the working hour.
Does it give you a different engagement with your audience though?
Not really. I think I still, when I go off to the work in progress, close that off fairly comprehensively. Close off all that chat. It's definitely a solitary world in there. There might be the odd idea that I take in with me in terms of how other people are progressing on their work. It's not as if I really feel as if those online worlds are in dialogue with the work, with my work. They're in dialogue with me, and then there are, you know, some things might leak through to the work, but really the thing between me and my work is...
Can it work as a warm-up process, just to sort of get you going, sitting down, doing your stuff, and then you get into your creative work?
Not so much
or
the
is
writing
it quite
itself,
a separate?
But viewing other people, because a lot of the people who I follow are writing and procrastinating themselves, watching them doing their things, watching them, you know, gear themselves up for the day's writing or just finish, because quite a lot of them are on the other side of the world as well. Just seeing that work going on all over the world, just seeing that there are quantities of people out there who are mad in the same way as I am and are trying for the same sorts of weird, hard-to-grasp things as I am is a heartening thing to go into the working day with.
Sea Hearts is published by Allen & Unwin.